Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Katie Lopez is a woman with resilience. She is the founder and creative director of sustainable underwear brand Stripe and Stare, but her journey to get there has been anything but smooth sailing. Katie has faced more than your average setbacks, and today she tells me about the tools she used to overcome finding out that her husband, and therefore herself, were £1.5 million in debt, a relationship breakdown at the same time, and a heartbreaking loss, and to come out on the other side with a growing company and growing self-confidence. She says, I didn't have the confidence in myself until life tested me and I had no choice. Her story is incredible. She is incredibly open about it and a real testament to the fact that sometimes you just have to put your big girl pants on and find a way through. I cannot wait for you to hear her story and what she's learned from it. Before we get into this episode, please go and follow and rate this podcast. It is not something that you naturally do. I never go and rate and follow podcasts until I realized how much it helped the podcast to be able to continue and to be able to get amazing guests on, just like it does for this one. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm very excited. As I do with everyone, I want to start at the very beginning. I would love to hear a little bit about what your life was like growing up.
Yeah, sure. Not particularly exciting. I grew up in Devon in the middle of nowhere. Proper sort of rural kind of wild childhood. The doors used to just open first thing in the morning. I was one of four. I don't think we wore shoes. It makes us sound like we were really feral. My mum will get really upset, but we just had freedom, you know, so we just used to run around. And if we didn't come home for lunch, it was no big deal. We were just out and about. So really independent, but free-spirited and a lot of fun. I had two big brothers who kind of teased me incessantly. And yeah, we all just grew up as a like, kind of like bundle of children and dogs and all of that sort of thing.
And did you ever think at that age or at any point kind of when you're at school that you were going to be an entrepreneur?
Absolutely not. Like, I'm quite a lot older than you. I'm 47. And it was just, I will get onto the women in business later, but it just then, even more so than now, you just wouldn't have thought of it as a right. woman growing up. I wanted to be a doctor or an actress or God knows, I had no idea basically, but I was obsessed with film and cinema. So I was also really interested in doing something in production, but there were a couple of telltale signs that this might happen. I set up a video club at school. You guys won't even know what, do you know what I mean
yeah,
by a VCR?
Yeah, no, I do.
I went around school and I got everybody to tell me what was in their VHS collection at home. And then I had basically a rental service. So
you
I'd be like
Netflix. You invented Netflix.
Well, it was Blockbuster Video, I think. And then they invented Netflix. So that was my little entrepreneurial school project. And the other thing we used to do is we lived next door to my grandmother and she had this beautiful garden. And I used to, so on Sunday afternoon, she'd open it to the public. So all these people would have to walk past our house to get to her garden. And my sister and I would set up a table outside our house. We'd go around the house and collect objects and put like a sticker on saying 50p. So we were basically selling off our parents' entire contents of their home to these people who were going away with like these beautiful china vases. So I think there was something there in entrepreneurialism and retail, but I didn't, there was no grand plan.
I haven't quite pinpointed it yet. Less scalable selling your grandma's.
And got in quite a lot of trouble for that.
So let's talk about your move into TV. Why did you want to get into TV?
So I did uni in Newcastle. I loved psychology, actually. That was what I studied. I was one of those people, actually, who probably shouldn't have gone to university because I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. But I did know that I was desperate to work in film and TV. I just loved that whole set culture. So every uni holidays, I would be a runner. Literally, I would, in those days, nothing was digital. So being a runner meant you literally were carrying tapes of film around Soho from one place to the next. I was just trying to get a break into the industry. I'd rather have worked in film, but I got offered a job in a TV station, so I took that instead. I just wanted a foot in the door, and I said, I'll come and be a PA for you for a year, as long as you get me a job on a set at the end of it.
And how did that work out?
It was good. It was good. They did, actually. But I, weirdly, I sort of transferred to Australia. So I did a year with working for this lady in television. And then I'm half Australian. So I wanted to go and live in Sydney. And they had a sister company there. So they got me a job on set over there.
And why did you end up leaving TV if it was something that, you know, at the beginning you thought was so
I know.
Of the end goal?
So I started in TV as typical like production assistant, researcher, and then I got offered this really big promotion. I would have been like the youngest producer, I think, at Channel 7 at that time. And I'd worked so hard to get there. The thing that put me off was I'd had a lot of female bosses. And so I was kind of on track to the executive producer role. And I was looking at these women and the sacrifices they were making in their personal lives. Just remember one boss constantly on the phone to her daughter saying, "Sorry, darling, I'm not going to make it." You know, and I was like, these women work so hard and they're just making so many sacrifices. It's like you can't have both in this industry. So I turned that job down. My boss literally couldn't believe it because he knew how hard I'd work for it. And I said, I want to go and do something different and I want to be able to control my life. I don't have a family. I didn't even have a boyfriend at the time. But I said at some point, I do want to have a family, but I also want to work super hard. So what is a life that I could create for myself, which will give me the opportunity to do both?
And what did you feel the job that would be able to give you both was?
So because I'd been living in Australia, my sister was there at the same time, we just felt there were so many amazing Australian brands that weren't available in England. Why we decided to do fashion retail, I still don't know.
It's not a lifestyle business.
It is not a lifestyle business.
It's a terrible lifestyle business to choose.
I know. Well, now whenever we talk about retail, I'm like, oh my God,
Yeah.
But we knew that going in, like we were quite smart. We did, not smart, clever, but we'd done a lot of research. We'd done business plans and all of that kind of thing. And we knew we had to find a subsidiary business to back the retail because that was never going to make us hugely profitable.
Right.
So we were always looking for something to back it with. We knew that we'd find something, but actually the retail then ended up doing better than we thought it was going to.
Right.
Some years it was profitable, some years it broke even, some years it made a loss. So it was like that constant, oh, I think we can get there. I think we can get there. I think we can get to a really healthy profit if we just do this and that and that. But actually then things like the credit crunch happened in 2008 and it was like, this is very, very difficult.
So at this stage in retail, you were running your own business?
Yeah, it was great. It was really hard work. It was in on the King's Road in Chelsea. Between 2004 when we opened and 2008, times were so good. You know, London was really flourishing. We had such an amazing customer base. We used to get people like Sienna Miller coming in all the time. And Kate Middleton came there actually the day after she got engaged. So like real moments like that. She didn't even call ahead to say, "I'm coming, close the shop." Just literally wandered in with her mum. And we were like, "You're now the most famous woman on the planet. And you're just doing your shopping like everybody else." So low key. So there were real like moments like that. And it was exciting because we were always looking for brands that you couldn't already get in London. So we were the first people to bring Zimmermann into the UK, Rag & Bone. We were the first London stockist. So there were real wins and fun times like that. But then 2008 happened and I was like, it's going to be very, very tough now. But what I had started to do was sell a brand of lacy G-strings from America.
Mm-hmm.
You'll probably know the one. And they were famous for being the world's most comfortable thong.
Right.
And women were coming in and buying armfuls of this product. And I was like, what is going on here? Because they weren't cheap. They were like £18 for a little rolled up ball of lace. But women would buy like 10 at a time. So then I got really interested in underwear. And I was like, well, the more research I did, I realized that actually underwear, it's probably a bit like what you do. Once women find a brand of underwear, they're more loyal to it.
Right.
They go back and buy the same thing again and again. So that really interested me. And I love the simplicity. Selling fashion, I love the simplicity of an underwear that's non-seasonal, really simple sizing, not lots of SKUs.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, well, it's great that we've got this thong, but we're British and we like a pair of pants. There was no one making a super sort of cool, soft, sustainable pair of knickers for every single day. And it was also a time we were beginning to understand the damage that fashion was doing to the planet. So I was trying to find a sustainable fiber that could do all of that as well. So I just started doing little production runs. I got my mum to make the first prototype on her sewing machine because I can't sew. Sorry, mum. And I used to go to Asia a lot for sourcing trips. So just sent it to a factory that I'd met and said, could you make some samples? And it literally went from there. We'd do small production runs. I'd sell them through the store. What do you like? What don't you like? Every single day to our customers. And then on the new production run, I'd tweak all the changes. So that went on for about quite a long time, about 6 or 8 years. But by the end of it, it became our best-selling thing in the store.
Really?
And then Alana Weston, who was the chairwoman of Selfridges, deeply passionate about sustainability, she got given a pair and literally her office called and said, how quickly can you come and start selling Selfridges? So I was like, hmm. And the retail was so hard. It was so, so hard, as we've just talked about. You know, by the time you've paid your rent, your staff, your cost of goods, there's nothing left over and you're working 7 days a week. Mm. And I had small children at this point and it was just unsustainable. I then spoke to the Shopbot buyers, which is a big American retailer, and said, you American women don't wear knickers, do you? You will wear thongs. And she was like, actually, no, the younger, cooler customers, they're actually pivoting more to a fuller brief shape. It's kind of cooler because technology's moved on, so you can get it without the VPLs and stuff. So it was at that moment that I really realized that I had something that was globally scalable with volume appeal and much more simple than what I'd been doing.
And this, at this point, was this called Cheek Frills?
So the early prototypes were called Cheek Frills. We were actually got picked. They were put in the V&A because they were doing a retrospective of women's underwear and how women's rights have mirrored trends in underwear.
That's interesting.
It's so cool. So we were next to a corset and it was like, that's the past and this is the future. Honestly, when you're making just like a fun pair of knickers and the V&A call you up and say, can we put your underwear in our exhibition? You're a bit like, why would you want to do that?
But, but okay.
So that was a cool moment. But yeah, so then Cheek Frills was the early prototype stage. And then I mean, honestly, people don't believe my story. We then got sued for trademark infringement. We'd done all the tests, all the checks, the company trademark checks, and had the all clear, but it was still going through the actual formal legal process, but we'd already launched it. So that was a huge learning. Is we then got a letter from this company in Austria saying, you're too close to our trademark cheek. Anyway, to cut a very long story short, the lawyers said you'll win, but the problem is the people we were fighting had bottomless pits of cash.
Right.
So I wish I'd given up the brand name sooner. That was a real lesson, is know who you're up against. I think if you get into a legal wrangle, even if you might be in the right, if they've got lots and lots of money, there's not a huge amount you can do about it. That was why we then started Stripe and Stare, is because then we had to start with a new name and a new team and all of that sort of thing. It was a really bad moment because it was also the moment that I was getting divorced and my personal life was basically disintegrating at the same moment. I think the universe is very funny at the way that everything does seem to come at once. It's never, you sort of go over periods that are really calm and chilled and then suddenly it's like,
yeah,
what did I need to learn here?
When it rains, it pours.
Exactly.
So you're at a point where you've developed a prototype, your business is growing, you're getting a huge amount of kind of success and recognition for it. And it feels like you've really kind of probably struck gold in a certain area.
I knew I had an amazing product.
Yeah.
I knew that to the very depths of my soul, because anyone who tried it said it was the best, most comfortable underwear they'd ever worn.
Which is the best thing to hear.
Running a business, even if it's a touchwood successful one, it's still fucking tough. So yeah, no, having that absolute belief in what you're doing is essential.
And at this point, when you kind of feel like everything's very much on the up, I know that kind of the rug was completely pulled out from underneath
you. So the trademark thing was happening. Yeah, so basically I had the week from hell. So on Sunday, my father died after a long battle with cancer. Monday, I found out my now ex-husband had been living a financial lie and we'd sold our house to fund his business. So we were in a rented house that basically didn't have a roof over our heads and I was like £1.5 million in debt. And then on Thursday, I was at my father's funeral and I got a call saying, your house has been burgled, like top to bottom. So yeah, people always do that face. People are like, really? Is this girl just demented? Like, is she making this up? Because that just can't be real. And you do. You're like, why me? Why has this happened to me? Why do I have to go through this? And but yeah.
Yeah. No, that's
it was
a lot.
It was a lot. But I am actually grateful for it, which sounds strange because I think these are the moments where you find out who you are, what you can do.
So I want to touch on that because I think that, you know, anyone who's going through something that really feels like rock bottom will definitely appreciate it. I think that, you know, you can expect some things to happen, but I can imagine your ex-husband at the time saying, this is what you think the case is. Actually, this is the reality. How did that feel when you were told that?
It was just total shock. there'd been a few red flags probably along the way, but I trusted him so deeply, and he'd been in finance. That was his world. I feel like such a naive, stupid woman for saying this now. And it's my big lesson. I've got a 15-year-old daughter, and I'm like, Connie, you take responsibility for your financial life every step of the way. I think it's probably quite different for you. When I, growing up, it was definitely a very patriarchal household, you know, like, not that my dad ran the house, you know, he was an amazing man, but, you know, the man was in charge, basically. And so I kind of grown up with that. I'm from like quite an old fashioned English background, probably. I actually once remember my father turning around to me and saying, well, I'll leave everything to the boys, but you're expected to marry well. I literally said that to me. I'm like, when I look back now, I'm like, oh, that's weird. But I just, yeah, I trusted him. I just trusted him. I thought he had it and he didn't. And I think probably because he was in the city in, I think, 2008, had a real impact on him probably mentally. And he went from having a very solid, the person you could trust with your life, to that not being the case. Maybe he felt like he couldn't provide for us. I don't know, because he wasn't open about it and he pretended everything was fine.
So you found out that you were 1.5 million in debt from his doing. That's tough to swallow, I can imagine.
It was really hard. It was really, really hard, because we were living such a lovely life and the children were at lovely schools in London. But so, yeah, it took about 2 years, I would say, to rebuild and get to a point where I kind of felt back to normal. What's normal, but you know what I mean? Like, it was 2 years of, I think I was in shock actually for a really long time after, like, 2 years.
I can't imagine. Like, I don't think we're programmed to get through anything like
that. It really was too much. Yeah.
And how did you emotionally get through that?
There were moments when I really didn't. I think there was never going to be a quick fix. I just remember all my friends and family around me just looking at me like, fuck, how are we going to help her? Like, what can we do? And there was just nothing that anyone could do. So the only way forward was slow and steady, making a lot of very tough decisions. I moved out of London, which is why I've moved back to Devon, because I had a support system there, much cheaper with the small children. My brother was really sweet and had a house that we could live in. I was so lucky, so, so lucky that I had an amazing group of friends and my family, big family. They pulled me through, I think.
Obviously, you talk about how that's changed your outlook on relying on someone financially, or kind of expecting something to be taken care of that you don't have oversight over. What tangible things would you tell yourself or your daughter in order to make sure you had that mindset, like, at the very beginning of when that happened?
I think it's accountability. It was probably too easy for me to, and not fair on him as well in a way, to just expect him to run everything, you know, and I should have made sure I knew what was going on and not just blindly trusted somebody. Knowing where the truth is and what's going on, and making sure you've got visibility on everything, because it's your life, it's your children's lives as well. Also trusting your instincts. I think there's a part of me probably that is from this very old-fashioned family, which probably slightly thought that men knew better than women. Awful to say, and you're 20 years younger, so hopefully your generation is a little bit more savvy and confident, I think, in their own abilities. I don't think I had any faith. I think I genuinely thought that men knew better at that point. It had sort of been brainwashed into me that men are the sort of clever ones who take care of things, whereas women just are there,
right.
And if they do have a nice job, that's great, good for them. But right. It was a real, like, fuck you, universe, fuck you, everything I've ever been told, fuck everything. I was fucking angry. I was like, how, I'm actually quite clever, quite capable. I'm not like a genius or anything, but I'm perfectly capable of running my own life. But I hadn't had that belief, I don't think.
Right. And there's an element of that as well, that it's kind of, you felt that because of what you'd been told, you were doing the good thing. Like, you were doing what you should be doing.
Like, the house was always lovely. The children were always having a lovely life. I was working though, and thank God for that. But I wasn't the breadwinner. I wasn't the main earner in the house. It felt like I had two jobs at once. It was really full on. You were always trying to be like, make sure he's had such a hard day, poor him. What does he need, for putting everyone else's needs before yourself?
And so how has all of this changed your mindset?
I think when you're faced with no option, literally no option, than to get up and make something happen, you just do it. And it's slow, it's steady, little baby steps, nothing too major all at once. But it's made me believe in myself. It's made me find out who I am. It's made me trust my instincts. It's made me realize how much more capable I am than I ever thought I was. Because now, look, I've got a 15-year-old who's so happy, taking over the world. God, she's confident. I'm like, where did you come from?
Probably growing up with you going through that.
Her and her girl. Well, they're all like it. I'm like, they do not take any shit from boys, from nothing. They're so, they have that internal, like, real strength and self-belief. It's amazing to see. I love it. And then I've got an 11-year-old, you know, and they're really happy children. They just normal, just, you know, touch wood, no big traumas have come out from all the drama yet, but they seem really on it and good. And then obviously I've got Stripe and Stare, which I'm so proud of because it's been so much easier. You know, you take your learnings from the first business you've had and really, like, there's a lot of mistakes I think you can avoid second time around.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
And so did you start Stripe and Stare up from scratch after the trademark situation?
Yeah, so moved to Devon and then started Stripe and Stare in 2017.
And how did you have the kind of ability to, while going through that, to start a business from scratch as well? Because it's not just that you found out that your husband is 1.5 million in debt and therefore you are as well. It's not just that you've obviously very tragically lost a family member. You've also lost your business from, you know, a trademark
thing. Yeah, that was
sort
of going on in the background. So right. That took about another year to kind of unfold. So I tried to make that work for another year after. But actually, I wasn't in the right headspace to even attempt to make something work.
Right.
I was still in, like, trauma and shock. And then dealing with this other big legal battle, this big legal battle on top of everything else that was going on. It was too much. It was too much. I shouldn't have tried, but I did. So did that. But then after Sheep Frills, I said, I do not ever want to see another pair of underwear ever again in my life. I'm fucking sick of knickers after all this drama. Talking about the universe again, it's funny, sometimes it goes for you even after it just got against me. An angel investor came to me and said, if you ever want to start something up, I've been watching you. I'd really like to back you. An old friend who I'd worked with was not enjoying her job as an MD. She'd actually just left and we had a cup of coffee and I said, look, I've got this angel investor, but I don't want to do it all by myself because I've been through all of this. I'm still, like, recovering from everything that's gone on.
Right.
But I knew I could do the sales, the PR, the marketing, all of that side, the product. I don't know how you do both, actually. I'm really interested how you balance your brain, because I think if I'm in that world, I find it really hard to be in the financial, operational world. Mm-hmm. So that's why I needed her to kind of be my rock, someone I could trust with my life, I think, after you've been through that sort of trauma. More than ever, people that you know you can rely on. That's how we found it, basically. Really small, basically 70K of investment. We did that on purpose. Someone actually then offered us more. We were like, no. We just want to do things organically, slowly. Then her husband died in his sleep, sort of just after we decided to found the business. So it was really weird. I think, again, the universe brought us together because it was my kind of healing working in that very small, gentle way. And that's what she needed to help get her through the trauma of grief as well. So it's just weird that we were both went through these amazingly terrible, tragic things. But we kind of had each other. We had the business. But the business did exactly what I wanted it to do. It allowed me to be a mother to my children and therefore all the important moments. It allowed me to work really hard, but completely on my own terms when I want to work. Like, I'll sometimes stay out really late, but it means that I can go to a netball match the next day or whatever. So it's been a real healing, cathartic part of the process, I think, the success of Stripe and Stare and building your confidence back up and providing a better future for the children. Yeah. For about the first 2 years, we did go very, very slow. But then it just grew sort of beyond our plans, projections, everything. And we got some analysts, some men, to run our KPIs. And they were sort of blown away by retention rates and AOVs. We began to realize, actually, we had something really mega on our hands. So at that point, we did take on quite quite a lot of investment, but we were ready for it then. We would felt like we knew what we were doing enough that it would really help to scale the business quicker.
And what do you feel like was the biggest turning point in the business's growth?
We were right place, right time, because it was all about comfort. And the other thing in 2008, when I first started researching and developing the product, you had Victoria's Secret at one end, you know, very male-gazy, really uncomfortable. Because you look at the runway shows now of all those perfect figures and everything, and it's just like, how was that only how was that ever happen? Okay with a man in a suit with gray hair at the front, like going, look at my ladies,
look at my angels.
And then you had Marks & Spencer's at the other end, which was uber comfy but dressed like your granny, like your Bridget Jones pants. So that was why the knickers, I was like, why is there nothing cool and comfortable? Like the same way Tala, you know, you throw on your leggings every day and you're kind of set. It's the same with our knickers. It's like you just want to put them on, and women have better shit to do than worry about wedgies, VPL,
right,
uncomfortable pants. Me Too happened in just as we launched. So I think that was another seismic shift in women kind of like going, what the fuck? I'm still dressing for a man. I'm still doing all this. When I think we realized we weren't quite where we thought we were.
Mm.
And then COVID, I hate saying COVID was good for us, but we were selling comfort. It was online. So we were able to keep trading. The first 3 or 4 years, we couldn't keep up with growth. We couldn't keep up with demand. Then we also did a lot of podcasts, actually, weirdly. We sponsored a lot of podcasts, which really no one else knew about podcasts, but because I was an avid podcast listener,
right,
I was like, well, we need to start sponsoring podcasts. So we did a bit of that, and no one else was doing it, so the rates were really cheap. So that just made us go boom. Like, we worked with Dolly Alton and Pandora Sykes, which was really fun, and then Fern Cotton, because I didn't know about paid marketing. I didn't know that I should be paying Google or Meta or whoever all of my marketing dollars, but so we were doing fun stuff with it rather than that. So it was a really happy, good time.
And how did you spot those opportunities?
I always followed what I liked. I'm really into like manifesting, and when I was going through my shit, podcasts actually were a really big part of like the healing process. I listened to tons of Oprah, Super Soul, Fern, Happy Place. So listening to those kind of inspiring women really helped on the journey. So we started off really small. We'd just gift. We had no paid influencer. We wouldn't be able to pay influencers to talk about us. We would just gift people that we liked and followed and said, if you like us, talk about us. But if you don't, don't. So it just snowballed from there. And eventually it was like, right, it's time to take the plunge and invest in something. And the first one we did was the Hilo. I remember it was £16,000 to sponsor 4 episodes. And it was so much money for us. We'd never spent any money on marketing at all. But I was like, I really think this is going to work. I really love this podcast. And I think everyone loves Dolly and Pandora. So we you know, you've got to take a few risks as well, haven't you? Yeah. We didn't bet the house, but it wasn't far off betting the house.
And I'm interested in how you managed to get back that need to take risks mindset when obviously you'd just been through something so that probably felt like the result of someone else's risk gone wrong.
I think I was so motivated. The business had to work because it was all we had. It was our way out of everything that had gone on. One day owning, I still don't own a house, but that's like my dream, is to buy our own house and that sort of stuff. It had to work. So I had to grow it quite quickly, and we had to take some risks. Do you know what? I don't know where that confidence and trust that was actually going to work came from.
I have a theory.
Tell
me. You'd like to hear it.
I would love it.
So, two things. I think that part of it is that probably you're truly and intrinsically an entrepreneur, and that's what entrepreneurs do. And I think entrepreneurs end up as entrepreneurs, whether they like it or not. So, you know, you've said many times that you wouldn't have thought of it as a career, and that you believe at that point you'd been told by society that we needed to rely on men and your job was in the house and like all of these different things. You still found entrepreneurship. So I think that says a lot. The second thing I think is that when you hit rock bottom, your mindset shifts so completely in terms of what is a risk and what isn't a risk. And instead of that being a risk, it's the opposite. Not doing those opportunities is the risk.
That is so funny that you say that, because probably my biggest fear, and this is since childhood, has been not finding out what I'm made of. How funny now that all this has happened to me with that. But my biggest fear would be getting to 80 and going, oh, what if I tried that? Like, what if I'd given it a go? My grandfather was a tennis player. In his day, he was like one of the best tennis players in the world. He won like Wimbledon and all that kind of stuff. He was a news agent by day, and then he'd go and play tennis in all of his spare time. But he had so much drive and the kindest, most charming man. You wouldn't meet him, but that stubbornness and that doggedness and that determination. And I wonder how much of it has come down from being surrounded by that kind of
Yeah, mentality. I also think it's ingrained in you as well. I think that it's like there are a lot of people who would have gone through what you went through and given up.
There was a moment I was someone like, else. I'm just going to go to Thailand and read books and eat noodles for the rest of my life. Honestly, it was a proper consideration. That used to run through my brain all the time. Tomorrow might be better. Tomorrow might be better. Mm. And that really kept me going.
Mm.
Sometimes I tell my story and I actually end up apologizing to people. I'm like, it's really not that bad. I'm fine. You don't right. need to worry about me. I'm okay, because it's so out there. But like I said a bit earlier, I'm really grateful it happened to me, because what would I be doing now if it hadn't? Mm. I wouldn't have found out all of these things that I was capable of. And there's still a long way to go with Stripe and Stare. We're not anywhere near there yet. But I'm so proud of all we've done. Like, we've got a team now of 30. I was reading your stats of your female workforce. We had our team days yesterday. Just the most amazing group of women, and we have a culture that's so different. The other thing about TV is I worked in an office where men used to call each other. I'm actually not going to say the C word because I hate it, but they used to literally be that rude to each other and like chuck mobile phones at their heads and things like that. I know. But it's just such a group of inspiring, positive, amazing women. We're B Corp, so, you know, we really look after everybody, we hope. We do our best to anyway. And the planet, so we feel like we're changing the world a little bit. Yeah, so I've found huge purpose in it, which I wouldn't have got if I hadn't been through that. But I'm still a bit like, why did I have to go through quite so much drama?
Could have taken that down by 50%.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Maybe I've just reframed it in my head to help kind of like understand it and process it a bit. I now get total control over my life. I know a lot of women my age who are dealing with ex-husbands who are like quite controlling with finances and lives and sort of mess them around with schedules. I am so deeply selfish. I am in bed watching Netflix by 9 o'clock. What I want to watch on Netflix, I eat what I want. You know, I've got my children. I can bring them up how I want. And everyone's always like, oh, have you met anyone new? And I'm like, fuck that. No. I just like being selfish at the moment and just controlling my world.
And so with that in mind, because you say you obviously were brought up in a way where certain things were expected and a certain life was expected. How would you have brought yourself up differently?
Hopefully I'm doing it with my daughter. It's about that self-worth and self-belief and believing that you are just as good as any other person in the room. You're not better, but you're certainly not worse. You know, we're all equal. Everyone's got their strengths. Everyone's got their weaknesses. You will have something in you that you're great at, and you just need to find that, and you'll be better than anyone at some things. But it's about knowing that you will have those skills and to believe in yourself.
Mm.
You have to work really hard, which I was always happy to do and always wanted to do. But yeah, it's about just the self-belief, the accountability, the confidence to go for what you want. Like, if you told me I would be running my own business, I would have been like, oh, I can't do that. How would I do that? Like, that anything is possible. And I hope my daughter really sees that. Actually, it's one of the big things that we do as a business is when we partner with other strong female voices like the Dollies and the Pandoras, I always make sure that it's somebody that I would want my daughter to aspire to be, because it's that achievement and pushing yourself. You'll know Brené Brown. I'm a big believer in all of her books and about the arena and getting in the arena and getting the shit kicked out of you. And otherwise, I'm not really interested in hearing what you've got to say. So that's what I want to see in my daughter, is somebody who's happy to go out in the world to fail, to get things wrong, because she will, to get the shit kicked out of her, but then just to keep getting up. I always say, my poor children, I have the Brené on the walls and I make them practice gratitude at dinner. I just want her to be brave enough to fail. I think a lot of women have that fear of failure. Certainly women of my age, a lot of my friends are like, God, my God, and how you do what you do, what if it doesn't work? And I'm like, well, it will work because it has to. And I just have that deep to my soul belief that it will.
It's so interesting because I do think, again, we've been taught as women to fear failure because of the way we see women who do fail. I think that, you know, our view in the media of women who fail, our view of entrepreneurs, like female entrepreneurs, we can all name the big ones who have been over every single newspaper of a kind of like, I told you so type press.
It's like the men just can't wait to say, oh, I knew she couldn't do it.
Right. But it's also of our own making, because we put them on a pedestal because we cannot believe that a woman would be in that position. Subconsciously, and we big them up and we say, this is a person who has it all. And the second they make a decision that wasn't the right decision, which is not only likely but required of, for example, an entrepreneur, we take away all of their value because of one single failure, which is why we're so ingrained to be terrified of failure. And actually,
I hadn't thought about it that way, but I think you're right.
That is why I think it's so important to see women failing publicly, and for it not to need to be gracious, for it not to need to be in a kind of accepted way, but for that just to be part of the narrative.
Yeah, and that's why my cheek frills part of it is interesting, because I have been through business failure as well as personal failure. Women are less tolerated when they fail. Or maybe other women are also quite competitive. I don't know. Maybe there's a part of us that we're jealous and why didn't I try that?
Yeah.
No, I don't think that's true, actually.
I mean, I would argue that's probably because we're taught that there's only a few spaces at the top. And so we're taught that we need to stamp on other women to make sure that we're
it's
the one of the
ones.
All
that language stuff, isn't it? I remember someone once saying to me, oh, Katie, you're the most ambitious person I know. And it wasn't meant as a compliment.
Right.
I took it as one.
Like,
but
thank
I
you.
Know it was from a man. It certainly wasn't meant as one. I know that you're passionate about the female entrepreneur statistics as much as me. Like, it's my real, everyone always says to me, oh, you're passionate about sustainability. And I'm like, no, actually, I just feel like sustainability is something that if you start a business, you should be doing.
Right.
It's just completely part agree. Of the process. Whereas my deep to my soul passion is women supporting women, having each other's backs. Truly believe like we rise by lifting others. Mm. I wouldn't have got my business off the ground if my mum hadn't given me free childcare. I mean, I would have been screwed. And weirdly, being an entrepreneur is sort of the perfect job for a single mother, because you can pick and choose your hours. But also women just don't have the confidence. I think that's a big part of it, to take a risk, to take a chance.
And so what advice would you give to another entrepreneur or another woman that's trying to build their confidence?
That it's slow and steady. There's no secret magic bullet to being an entrepreneur. It's just a lot of hard work, a lot of resilience. I'm such a believer in resilience. Well, obviously, given what I've gone through, but I think there was a Harvard Business Review that said actually 90% of success is grit. And I believe in that, because it is about who can get up the most and keep going, even when it knocks you, because it will knock you. God, Stripe and Stairs not perfect. There's still tons of knocks that come in, but I'm much better at dealing with that stress and just not getting caught up, not losing sleep over it, just finding a way through it. And I've made sure to surround myself with people who balance out my skill set, where we can lift each other up. If someone's having a bad day, there's someone else to pull you out of it. You know, just surrounding yourself with the right people, do the work, really hard work. Make sure you've got a product you really believe in. Never be shy to ask a question. I particularly found female founders, because I think we all want to help each other and we all want to help new women coming through.
Right.
I mean, I always say to my team, if you ask a question, what's the worst that can happen if someone says no? Like, so what? It's interesting, actually, when I was doing the knickers, and I think because I'm like you, not from a formal fashion background, and I think in some ways that was helpful for me, because I couldn't understand why there were all the heavy elastic seams in underwear, which is what gives you the VPL and the wedgie and all those things. And so actually, I spoke to about two or three factories at the beginning, and they said, well, you can't design a pair of underwear that's going to stay in place and not fall down without those elastic seams. And I was like, well, if you put the lace like that and you do this flat lock stitch, I think you can. So I actually had to persuade a factory to even sample it. I was like, why don't you just sample it and see if it works? And that's where it all came from. And I was like, this is perfect, because you don't get the digging in. So that's why it's, but I got a lot of no's as well.
And so do you think that entrepreneurship is a truly viable option for women who've really been through it, as you say, left with a huge amount of debt, a huge amount of kind of...
It's so hard, because I'm aware how privileged I am. You know, I had contacts and I had my mum to help with childcare. But I'm part of this group, and a lot of the chat on there is, what are we going to do about these statistics? This 1-2%, depends which piece of research you believe.
Either way, not great.
Let's call it 2.
2%,
let's be
fine.
Generous.
Yeah.
But what are we going to do about this? And I asked our VC, why don't you invest in more female businesses? It was actually a woman. She said, we're desperate to. The problem is we get a business plan, lands on our desk. First thing we do is take the numbers and we halve them. And then we go, right, if they do 50% of what they say they're going to do, is it still going to work? The problem is, as women, before they send it in, because they're risk averse, they've already done the halving. So by the time the VC does the halving again, you're down to 25%. So what business is going to work at 25% of their projections? Not many. As we know, the average investment into a female-led business returns 50% more. So, but because it's been set up in this patriarchal way, the investment system, I think, it's very much a man's world. So that means that because the halving process that goes on probably more cautious by nature, but still take the right risks. I don't know how to say it without sounding kind of sexist.
I mean, I've definitely like faced this myself. I mean, one thing we say every time we talk to investors is we will hit every single number we say we will. And we can say, and so yes, we can take the projections up for you, but we will hit these numbers.
We would rather surprise exactly. on the upside.
Yeah, and what we've done every single year is we have over-delivered and we have hit every single number we've said we will. And we've said you can talk to any single investor who we've worked with and they will tell you
the I've one, heard that from the exact so same. Many of my investors. Exactly. It's like, I look forward to getting your report because you're going to surprise me on the upside.
Right. And the problem is with the VC world, especially in this kind of traditional more US-based VC, all of these types of things where people are being given tens of millions at pre-seed stage before they've even gotten tested an idea. Yeah. It is all based on imaginary numbers, obviously, with some guesstimation. I do, however, not think it's women's fault. And I do think that there is an element of it where the...
No, it's not our fault at all. It's the pressures we put on ourselves, our lack of confidence.
Yeah, but even then that sounds like a women-inflicted issue. I mean, there will absolutely... Every time I talk about the kind of funding thing and people are like, not trying to be rude, but is there an element of it that like women aren't trying to go for this funding as well? It's like, oh, this could account for some of it. It's not going to account for 98% of this.
There's a really interesting TED talk. Some researchers sat in on investment meetings. So, you know, the entrepreneur going to a VC or whoever and saying, invest in me. The language that was used that was negative in the female meetings compared to the male meetings, it was off the charts. Women get asked all these negative questions. What are you going to do if it fails? What are you doing to protect the risk? Whereas the men were all being asked questions like positive, like, you know, just completely different. So yes, it is. There's an intrinsic bias that people don't even know is going on.
I was thinking about it a lot yesterday because, as you said, I had quite the experience yesterday with mainstream media and investment and men. And as part of that, I was really thinking, because, you know, I do understand that there will be part of it that's kind of like fewer women are going for funding and we need to address that and like all of that as well. But I also think that like it's so classic that that's our defense, when it's like, if you make something really terrible for someone, like if you say, you know, you're not going to be able to do this, you're not going to be able to do this, you don't invest in anyone, you make the statistics terrible, and then you're like, why aren't women going for this? It's like, you can't make an environment terrible and then be surprised that people aren't
able to
doing
thrive
it
in it. Yeah.
Because also people can't take that risk because it is too much of a risk. Whereas if it is less of a risk for men to go for investment, like full
it
stop.
Is. No, it is. Yeah.
So we can't say that it's because women aren't going there when we're saying, don't come here, we're not going to give you any money. I don't know. I think about it a lot. Obviously.
I think about it a lot too, and I don't know how to fix it and how to change things. So the Rose Review, I thought, was really spot on with its women have so much more family pressure on them. They're not in a position to take risk often, whether that's looking after small children or elderly parents or running the household. The childcare, I think, is massive. Like, if I hadn't had free childcare, I wouldn't be able to do this. I know that they've reduced the rates and things, but it's nowhere near.
Yeah.
It's nowhere, because the burden of it still massively falls on the woman in the house. And if you're a single mother, it's 100% on you. And then it's the confidence. And I think, God, you're going to be amazing for future women, my children, my daughter's age, because it's, I don't know, if you could see it, you can be it. That's 100% true. So I think the more of us that are out there working together to show the next generation coming through what's possible, and that we're just as good as men, and that we probably will return 50% better on your
investment.
And
actually we do return 50% better.
Yeah, so we're better, do you think?
So maybe you're just scared. Maybe you're scared we'll make you too much money and you won't know what to do with
taking
it.
Taking your jobs.
Well, I think that is a perfect, very frustrating, but perfect way to end. I think we could talk about this all day.
I know, I just want to find a way of taking positive, I think we're people who like to see results, probably. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we will find a way to change these numbers.
We will. We will. Watch this space. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Grace.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5.
From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.